better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spearco with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, April the 3rd, 2025. And this is episode 3,651 of the Survival Podcast. It is Thursday, so it's time for Expert Counsel Q&A show for the week. Got a great lineup for you today. Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams will ask a question and attempt to answer it. And that is, what happened to the peace president that America voted for? Also, we're bombing Yemen, threatening Iran. Like, Trump actually campaigned on ending wars, no new wars, etc. What's going on there? Andy McCann will talk about how to show your fitness. And I'm saying that's like your proof of work and results. We'll talk about the CrossFit Games, some Hydrox Race stuff, a DECA Fitness Challenge. And he has a special page for you guys on his own website to help you out with your fitness goals. Jeff Lawton will talk about how the problem can be the solution. We had somebody write in with a problem. Basically, that weed trees ate their food forest. There's a clearing cut out, and all these like sumac trees and stuff like that's growing back in. What about the problem being the solution? What if we let the weed trees effectively be pioneering species and use them as a high carbon source for composting and mulching? And if we did that, we could even choose the time of harvest so that the weed trees are ideally sized to go straight into a chipper shredder. That's a good plan. Jeff will talk about that. Speaking of trees, Kerry Brown is still out on his quest to find more edible blossoms off of trees in springtime. This time he talks to us about sassafras, and I have an update for you. Just like every year, the black locusts are here, and they are here now. Between last week and this week, it all happened. Chef Ken Daniels will talk. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about cooking tilapia and actually having some dadgum flavor in it without breading it and deep frying it. Ryan Steva will talk about homestead project debt and how to avoid it. Now, you probably think what I thought when I got the segment, because this was not a question. You probably think he means financial debt. Not really. I love this angle from Ryan. We'll talk about that. And then I'm going to talk to you about the tariffs, the dreaded tariffs. I'm going to tell you that almost everything the media and the left is saying about the tariffs, bullshit. But almost everything Trump's saying about the tariffs is also bullshit. The reality is this is not as simple as either side is making it out, and the actual outcome is yet to be determined. But it probably ain't doomsday, and it probably ain't liberation day at the same time. I'm going to try to come at this with the Jack view, the no bullshit redneck hippie duck farmer with some actual economics education along the way. And we're going to try to talk about this in a way that maybe will make more sense from a standpoint of, well, what does this mean for me? What should I do? Do I need to be worried? Do I need to be more prepared? We'll talk about it when we get to that anchor segment. Now, with that in mind, I was going to say let's jump on in, but let's remind you of a couple things first. Number one, I will be at the end of this month up at in Tennessee at Nicole Sauce's place for the Living Free in Tennessee workshop. I will be there, and I'll be doing hands-on composting and biochar. So we'll be doing both of those, and there's a ton of other really great speakers, lots to learn. It's a hell of a good time. If you've always wanted to come here for one of my workshops and you haven't been able to because of timing or what have you, consider doing Nicole's, and you'll get to meet me and a lot of other really cool people. The other thing is we have a Permaculture Pond Masterclass that's available from Ben Falk as well that I wanted you guys to know about. It's really impressive what he's put together. And this guy is an aquascaping genius. He really is. I've been impressed with his work from a pond building standpoint, going all the way back to when I spoke at a PDC as a co-instructor with him at his place. God, that's well over 10 years ago, and he's only gotten better at what he's doing. So definitely check out this Permaculture Pond Masterclass. Both of those things will be in the Daily Mail today. But if you just go look up today's episode, 3651, they're in the sponsors for the day links for the show, as all the other cool stuff is. With that, let's plunge on in with Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams and find out, well, what happened to the peace president?
one of the things we're going to be talking about is the foreign policy of Trump. And it's not exactly a message of peace
yeah.
and constitution, but it reminded me of all the promises of George H.W. Because I remember he was very promising that we were not to be the policemen of the world and all that. What did we end up with?
Humble foreign policy is what he promised.
What we want to talk a little bit about is targeting Iran, whether it's through Yemen or directly with Iran and this sort of thing. But he's literally using a dangerous talk.
Yeah, it is.
Well, already here on anti-war. Trump threatens Iran with bombing if nuclear deal is not reached.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's on whose terms.
His
turn.
Maybe he's bluffing. The problem with bluffing all the time is that people never know when you're telling the truth. Is he doing it? Is he not doing it? Is he going to bomb us? Is he not going to bomb us? And the danger, I mean, maybe you can do that in a real estate deal. Oh, that bathroom is totally fine. Trust me, the toilet works fine. But when you are dealing in world affairs, the Iranians, if they don't think he's bluffing, they may do something based on what they perceive, rightly, it sounds at least to me, as a threat to be bombed. They may react in a way that would take us down the road to war, which is unnecessary. That's the problem with bluffing in foreign affairs, you know. And I think, you know, President Trump ran as a peace candidate. I will stop the wars. I will get us out of wars. And in fact, I think he appealed to a large portion of Libertarian Party people and libertarians, and the party itself endorsed him for president on the basis of him being a pro-peace and pro-prosperity president. Well, leaning into war like he's doing is, as you said, anti-peace and anti-prosperity. Well, let's take a look at, we're buried in the lead a little bit here, but let's take a look at what we're talking about. And this is from Axios. Anti-War did a good write-up about it. I think Politico did a good job as well. But here's the Axios piece. Trump threatens Iran with bombs unless nuclear deal reached. Go to the next one. Here's his quote. Over the weekend, apparently he called an NBC News anchor and said he was mad about a few things. He used the word P-I blank blank E-D. Maybe it happened. He didn't deny it. But here we go. President Trump threatened to bomb Iran if the Islamic Republic doesn't reach a new deal with the U.S. on its nuclear program. As you point out, Dr. Paul, they had a deal with the United States, and Trump canceled it. So what kind of a new deal would it be, A? And B, why would they trust Trump if he canceled the deal in the first place? And they say, why it matters, Trump wants to engage in diplomatic talks with Iran, has leveled threats against it before, but this is the strongest and most serious. Here's what he said, quote, if they don't make a deal, there will be bombing. It will be bombing the likes of which they have never seen before, Trump told NBC News Kristen Welker during a phone interview. Bombing like they've never seen before, and he gave him a two-month deadline. Let's get a deal by 2 months or we're going to bomb you.
Yeah, I don't think he should get a very good grade on diplomacy.
Again, people are saying that this is Netanyahu's dream to get the U.S. to fight its war against Iran. He did it against Iraq. If you remember, he went into Congress in 2002 and said, believe me, if you attack Iraq, there's got to be peace in the Middle East. Right? How did that work out?
Yeah.
And they're doing the same thing with Iran.
About the only thing that I don't even know if disagree, but I have a different view on. When Dan was talking about how the problem with bluffing is, if you're bluffing all the time, people don't know if you're bluffing. That actually, if you're going to bluff, that's a good thing. The fact that Trump can appear unhinged and that, you know, there are foreign governments that are like, is he bluffing or not? Like, I'm not saying the tactic is good, but I'm saying if you're going to come out this way and you're like, we're going to bomb you if you don't do the thing, you better be able to do it in a way that makes them like, I don't know if it's real or not. I don't know. That is a pathway. It's not necessarily the right pathway, but it is a pathway to diplomacy. And a person who you know is bluffing can't do it, right? Like, we've all played poker with a person and you're like, this asshole bluffs all the time. And because they bluff all the time, when they're not bluffing, when they actually have a good hand, you know it. When you are a guy that's pulled some of the bullshit he has and continues to pull, and just at sometimes you're like, is this guy unhinged? You're a good bluffer. I'm not, again, I'm not advocating. I'm just saying it does work to the advantage of what you're trying to accomplish if the other party ensure what's going on here. Anyway, it can also work against you. Don't get me wrong. Let's talk about fitness and your proof of work with Andy McCann.
Hello and good morning, TSP World. This is Andy McCann, and I live out here in Woodstock, Georgia. I own CrossFit Garage, and I do a lot of health and fitness, and I'm trying to help you guys live that healthy life now or into the future. And I got a question here from Tim from Georgia. Hey, Tim, if you're in the Woodstock area at all and you're listening to the Survival Podcast and you like CrossFit, then come to Woodstock and join us, right? Or just pop in. So you've got my email, guys, if you ever need me. It's andy@CrossFitGarage.com. Okay, so Tim's question was, hey, Andy, this health and fitness stuff is kind of neat, but how could I put it into practice or maybe do some competitions? I've heard of things like Hyrox and Decafit. What is that and how would it play into what you do? I'm like, hey, this is a great softball. Thank you very much. Maybe we do know each other already and you just fed me an easy one. Guys, I believe your health and your fitness and your wealth and your preps are super important. I sort of believe my mission in this world after working with Nicole and her My Three Things and setting up vision and purpose is to help the people that are in my sphere live longer, because I like what you're doing and I want you guys to be able to send the message out there, right? So if you're in my sphere, my Venn diagram, then yeah, I want to help you live longer. Even if you're not, I probably want to help you live longer. But you know what I mean. I have a passion for you people and I want you guys to have the best life you can. All right, so he asked, what can I do? I'm going to go down the road of competitions because you mentioned Hyrox and Decafit. I'm going to talk to you guys about this. This is for anybody. But first, if you, I created a page specifically for all of Jack's people. So if you go to my website, crossfitgarage.com/TSPC, you're going to find all the stuff that I've been talking about. If it makes it onto the show, then I'm putting it here so you can find it. So it's got some carnivore challenge, the 60 easy, so that's the one to combat 75 hard, the 32 at-home workouts, Garage Fitness Online podcast, at-home test. I need to put that stretching one too in there. I forgot to do that. Anyway, that is there for you guys. You can join us at GarageFitness.online, where we give you programming. If you've got a bit of a home gym, it works. If you've got nothing, don't go into that. You need some stuff first. Okay, so the one that's probably near and dear to my heart is the CrossFit Open. You may think to yourself, wait, I don't even do CrossFit. How could I do this? You totally can. They have a three-week competition, so every Thursday they release a workout, and you just have to do it and post your scores. If you want to be official, you want to videotape yourself and all that, but we're just doing it for fun. Nobody cares what your score is. We're not winning. It's just to track stuff and see how you're doing throughout the world. Now, realize this. When you do something like the CrossFit Open, the people doing that are people who want to log their scores. So when you log your score to see against everybody else, it's against people who are logging their scores that are interested in this. So, of course, you're probably going to be on the other side of the bell-shaped curve because they're probably fit, right? Not everybody is. Some people are just jumping into it. But I wanted to kind of give you an example of what they do in the workout. So they usually have three levels in the open, the as prescribed, which is kind of tough, the scaled division, and then a foundations. I'm just getting started. I would recommend every one of you do foundations and see where you fit, right? So this is going to be people who really don't know what they're doing, and that would be us, right? For most of us. I know some of you guys are actually doing CrossFit. So as an example, in the RX division, the hard part would be the pull-ups that then would go to chest to bar pull-ups that would then go to bar muscle-ups. And you're thinking, I don't even know what that is. Totally fine. The scale drops that back. You have jumping pull-ups, regular pull-ups, and then chest to bar pull-ups. But foundations makes it even easier. They always use jumping pull-ups. So you'll be A-OK, right? So this is literally made that everyone can do it. And what it's going to do is help build a capacity in you to know where you're at. So it's a great thing. It's happening very soon. I think it's going to launch March 1st. So if you wanted to get into that, you got to kind of get in there soon. I never know when Jack will actually post these. So it might already be past the time. Sorry about that, Jack. The next thing, you can do this anytime, is Hyrox. Hyrox is a similar-ish event, except it's very known. So the other one is unknowable. They don't release the workouts until the Thursday beforehand. But in Hyrox, it's running and then a couple different stations. If you go to their website, you can click into all the races. And usually they have one big race in some of the bigger cities, and it's at a convention center. And I'm going to tell you what the events are. So they call it a fitness race. Between each of these elements, you're going to be running a 1 mile, so it's a long event. You can do miniature ones, but those are put on by affiliates and stuff. But This is the big competition. Anyway, there is a ski erg. So imagine yourself skiing. You're just pulling down on these ropes. There's a sled push, a sled pull, a burpee broad jump, rowing, farmer's carry, sandbag lunges, and wall balls. You don't really need to know how to do any of those. You can go online and look at a video and see, and then gauge from there and figure it out. Or go to a CrossFit gym and say, hey, teach me how to do these things, and they totally will. Be totally fine. But these events happen all over the world, and it is a quickly growing event series that people are loving. So we're getting into it in our gym as well. Okay, so the other one is, and that's HYROX, H-Y-R-O-X, HYROX, which is spelled uniquely. It is a European-based company. I don't know where it started from in Europe, maybe England or something. But anyway, the other one is DecaFit, which is super similar. The biggest difference here is it's with Spartan, and so it's kind of that world of events. So they have a lot bigger reach, especially here in America. Go to their site. You can hit races. They have their big DecaFit competition, and there is Ollie the Great Pyrenees. All right, so my coyote dog is here to say hello. He's protecting me from the non-hair, so now I am very hairy. But they've got three styles. You can do the full event, which is very similar to the HYROX one. now he wants to leave. I love Ollie. He's a great dog. I wouldn't have him without Jack, you jerk, for getting me into chickens and the coyotes being so hard to keep away. So love that dog, but he is super hairy. Anyway, DecaFit. So they have different options. Some have running, some don't have running. You can do it an affiliate at a smaller gathering, or you can do their big event. But these things are kind of fun and neat and very standard, so you're going to get the same experience every time. It's like running the same 5K with the exact same environment and the same route. It's a good way to test your fitness to see where you're at. So I would be curious, you guys, if you don't do anything, try this. Email me back. Let me know how it went. I'm going to be doing some of these. It's going to be a whole lot of fun. So if you want to put your fitness into practice, hey, I got to get out of Dodge. Let me do some of this and see where I fall into this world of health and fitness. All right, guys, if you need help, I am here for you. Again, this is Andy McCann here with CrossFit Garage, and my podcast is Fitness, Food, and Finance. Y'all take care.
Okay, good stuff from Andy. And I have all the links he mentioned to the various competitions and to the TSPC specific page at CrossFit Garage in the show notes. Again, episode 3651, look for Andy's bullet point. You'll see four sub-bullets all hyperlinked over to the resources that he mentioned for you. Now let's talk about turning a problem into a solution. And what do I mean by that? Well, we have a person here who put in a food forest, and as he described it, weeds, and he really means weed, trees, and shrubs, ate my food forest. So basically, he planted productive species, and these weedy species, which are really, if you listen to the species mentioned, it's like locust and sumac. These are pioneering species. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. Now, when you put a food forest in the right way, you generally want to plant a lot of pioneering species anyway, and you're constantly doing a chop and drop. But there is another way to maybe speed up the results of chop and drop, or turn this entire problem into a solution. But I will say it is not a low labor solution, but it's also a solution that only needs to be enacted for a while. If you do what Jeff's about to explain to you, within a couple seasons the problem will stop being a problem as a solution. The problem will become a non-problem. So Jeff, how do we handle a situation like this?
Let's say tuna farm and just about all of our projects, the engine of fertility that drives soil fertility is decomposition through composting, high-grade compost. And compost is a large part carbon. So 25 parts carbon to maybe 30 parts carbon to one part nitrogen. So it's understandable that it's pretty easy to get some nitrogen. A few legume trees chipped up or legume bushes chipped up, the peas and beans, some manure, and you're there. But where do you get the high-carbon material? It's sometimes quite difficult to get carbon material that's slow to break down. So it has to have a large surface area. You can have big lumps of manure. You can have big lumps of high nitrogen foliage. It'll break down because it's got a high nitrogen content in the compost heap. It won't be difficult to turn because it'll fall apart quick. But high carbon has to be chipped with a large surface area or even sawdust if it's real hardwood. But it's not always easy material to deal with if it's hard and woody and something that has a real resistance to being cut up, we've found using a chipper, either on a tractor or a motorized chipper, you can specialize in chipping material that's very quick to chip, quick in time, very little fuel, because we choose our chip material. And most of it's real weedy, woody plants or trees. Weedy trees grow fast. That's why we call them weeds. And they often grow straight. If we now this sounds funny. If we manage our weedy trees, we can make them grow very straight. They have nice foliage at the top, real straight stems. We can let them grow to exactly the size that goes through the chipper really quick. And we can create all the material for a compost heap in less than an hour. All the high carbon material, that is. We get some green material going through, but we get a lot of carbon really fast because we choose the material that we drive into the cycle of large surface area, high carbon. Now, all over the world, you'll find that there are trees that people hate. We are using Tacoma stands. We actually use woody material like the woody stems of cassava from our crop. We also use any woody material that's really soft and chips easily and is straight. It's no good being all branchy. Tacoma stands is one of our weedy trees. It's almost illegal to grow some of these trees, but you could actually set up a cultivation for your compost. Compost cultivated weed trees, I think I should call them. So you've got trees like Tree of Heaven, sometimes called Ghetto Queen in Hungary. You get the picture. You've got trees like Devil's Fig in Australia, Erythrina, Wild Tobacco. They're all trees that are quite soft, grow fast, easy to grow if you want to try and grow them. And they'll grow straight. And fast, straight, and quite soft. Go through the chipper quick. Great trees to build compost. Now, if you're building compost, you can grow forests that actually shades out the weeds. So you're putting the weeds into fast action of succession of high quality shade that shades out the weeds and they're no longer a problem. So at some point, if you still want compost, you've got to actually try and cultivate some of these to keep your fast compost in. High carbon, large surface area input for compost. What a beautiful way to think about elements that most components that most people don't want as a component and think they're an enemy. Typical human thinking. Enemies often the asset that we need to understand.
Good stuff from Jeff. Let's hear from Carrie Brown on sassafras. And I'll give you a little update before Carrie goes on about sassafras. If you're in a more northern climate, you may not have had this happen yet. But I mentioned last week when Carrie was talking about, I think redbud is what he was talking about, that we had a lot of redbud here, but we had not yet had the beautiful white flowers of the black locust come. And we are in blossom season now. They are everywhere. They just exploded between the time I said it and the end of the weekend. I'm happy. My wife isn't. Why? Because you have a couple of them near the pool, and when they start dropping their blossoms, which they start dropping some of them right away, they go in the pool and they float, and they go in the skimmer, and she gets mad and wants me to cut them down. And I have to remind her every year it only lasts about 2 weeks. And so we get through that and we don't kill those trees. Anyway, let's hear from Carrie on sassafras flowers. This is something, when I lived in Pennsylvania, there was a lot of sassafras on the mountain. And I did play around with sassafras quite a bit. Never even occurred to me to think about the blossoms of the sassafras tree. Carrie, tell us about that.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie Brown here from Strong Roots Resources. And since we're in the early weeks of spring, and we've got plenty of trees budding out around here, I've kind of been on a mission to see which of those are edible, and if so, how tasty are they? So, just a little while ago on my evening walk, I was taking a look at the sassafras trees, which are, at this point, actually flowering. Some of them are still in bud mode, depending upon their personal little microclimate. And I've known that, you know, all parts of the tree are edible and medicinal, but I don't think I've ever actually taken the time to try out the flowers or the buds. So I did. And the result is they're pretty good. The early buds are definitely, they definitely have that stronger sassafras flavor, that kind of aftertaste. Pretty robust. Not quite like the root, but pretty strong. And as they develop more into their flower, they're actually mild and fairly sweet. I found those to be more palatable and more enjoyable. I could definitely see dressing up a salad or even something like a fruit salad with these. I think that would be wonderful. So there you go. Take a look at your sassafras trees. We have several here on the farm. If you guys have been around me for any length of time, at some point you will hear me speak about my enthusiasm regarding the sassafras tree. It is such a robust and tolerant tree of rocky clay soils, and it'll form pretty thick groves at times. They're pretty much cloning off of the same root structure, so it's easy to get a lot of trees in one spot, and when they're dormant, they actually transplant relatively well if you get them between about 3 and 4 feet of growth and you dig them when they're completely asleep in the wintertime. So I hope you guys can take a look for some sassafras trees in this kind of small window and let me know what you think. We'll talk to you guys next time.
Sadly, I just don't have a lot of that around me because that sounds freaking delicious. Kind of like a brutish beer, sweet, flavory thing in a salad. That might be even better than the slightly sweet pea flavor from my beloved locust blossoms. Anyway, if you have sassafras around you, now would be the time. And in the show notes, right under Carrie's bullet point, you'll see a sub-bullet hyperlink to an image that he mentioned of a sassafras blossom to help you with identifying this plant. Remember, whenever you're foraging, no matter what you heard from anybody, be sure of what you stick in your mouth, because once you swallow it, you've done what you've done. And some of the things you swallow can make you sick, or miserably sick, or dead. Now, that's probably not going to happen here, but it is a good rule to always keep in mind. Always pretend that anything you eat can kill you, because in fact, if you eat the wrong thing, it can. Now let's talk about something that's never going to kill you, eating tilapia, but it can be kind of bland. Chef Ken will give you an idea for cooking tilapia in a much better way.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today's question comes from Jerry. Any suggestions to make my tilapia and already an amazing fish even better? Yeah, Jerry's been doing aquaponics for 12 years and has a population of about 150 fish. Some of these are ranging up to 20 to 24 inches, so good job with that, Jerry. In this email, he talks about breading and pan frying them, which I think are pretty good options. But let's talk about something else. Let's get into this for Jerry. Now, for some of you, I know what you're thinking. Tilapia, really? Yeah, tilapia has a bad reputation problem. You've probably heard people complain it's bland or question its farming methods, and yes, most tilapia available is farm-raised, and quality can dramatically vary. But here's one thing. Good quality farm tilapia actually exists, especially if you're raising it like Jerry. And it's a great lean protein source that's really budget-friendly. So let's get into this. For many of us that don't farm our own tilapia, we are forced to buy at the market. So you should always look for responsibly farmed, sustainably sourced tilapia. Labels like Aquaculture Stewardship Council and Best Aquaculture Practice certifications kind of give you a nice warm, fuzzy feeling. This does ensure better farming practices, cleaner water conditions, and higher nutritional quality. Really, what you're trying to avoid are sources from China, Vietnam, or really most Asian farm-raised sources. They can and do have some questionable practices. So how do you spot poor quality tilapia? Really, what I'm looking for is dull, cloudy, or overly slimy flesh, and always avoid fish with strong off-putting odor. Good quality tilapia, or really any fish, should smell fresh, look clean, and feel firm to the touch. So let's talk about size, because when it comes to tilapia, bigger isn't always better. Smaller tilapia fillets tend to have a tender, delicate texture that's perfect for these quick cooking methods. On the flip side, larger tilapia fillets are often firmer and can have a slightly tougher texture, which can be good in some situations. Do not dismiss larger tilapia. They are fantastic for techniques that require sturdier fish, like grilling or dehydrating. Larger tilapia fillets dry well. You can dehydrate these fish fillets until super crispy, pulverize them into powder, crush up some dehydrated shrimp, and you've got a potent seafood seasoning perfect for soups, stews, stocks, or even just dusting over grilled veggie. Also consider keeping the skin on during cooking. This isn't always an option for those of that are buying from the market, but if you do farm raise, tilapia skin crisps beautifully when pan fried. Okay, let's talk cooking. One of the main complaints about tilapia is that it's lean, and lean fish can easily become dry and flavorless. My two secrets to transforming tilapia from bland to delicious are fat and spices. Adding fat doesn't just enhance flavor, it preserves moisture, helps you avoid overcooking, and elevates this mild fish into something that's worth savoring. And tilapia is like a blank canvas. I can be fairly aggressive with all kinds of regional spices, and tilapia will hold up. Some fish are just too delicate or just too potent to have this happen. So think about cooking methods like pan searing in butter, baking in olive oil, or using rich animal fats like tallow and duck fat. Trust me, introducing a dose of fat dramatically upgrades the taste and texture. So I'm going to pass over the pan fried and breaded options because Jerry seems to have this down. So let's look at a few of my favorite other cooking techniques. First, butter basted tilapia. Season fillets generously, salt and pepper. Melt quality butter in a pan with garlic and herbs. And this garlic and herb mix, it will infuse in the butter. You're going to know it's ready when the smell and the aroma is just intoxicating. Gently lay your fillets down, spooning hot butter over them as they slowly cook. This technique creates a golden crust and adds an unbeatable richness. Plus, the remaining infused butter will create an incredible butter sauce for your dish. Number two, parchment baked tilapia. Cooking fish in parchment paper is a classic French technique that locks in moisture and flavor. You just don't hardly see it here in the States very much. I basically lay out a piece of parchment paper that allow me to fold over the fish almost like a Christmas present. Lay your fillets on a parchment paper. I add thinly sliced vegetables like fennel, leeks, bell peppers, zucchini. Add some herbs, lemon zest, salt and pepper. Then I drizzle it with olive oil or just a pat of butter. I fold and seal the parchment paper around the fish. The idea is to make it airtight, it builds steam, and it bakes for about 15 minutes at about 375 to 400. So cooking tilapia this way gently steams it with these aromatic vegetables and herbs. It remains tender, juicy, and it's infused with flavor. Lastly, the fun one. So I basically simmer tilapia in like a Thai curry infused coconut milk with fresh ginger, lime, and cilantro. Poaching is a low and slow technique that is like a hot bath that slowly cooks the tilapia. This not only infuses incredible flavors, but maintains a perfect tenderness. Again, the remaining liquid can be reduced and made into a wonderful coconut curry sauce. Recipes are with Jack. Jerry, I hope these ideas help. Tilapia, when done right, it's affordable, delicious, and incredibly versatile. Give these techniques a shot and see how quickly tilapia becomes just this reluctant choice because you've got it on the farm to one of your family favorites. Let your taste buds be the judge. Check me out at drinkeatlearn.com and my new site, bloodsugarchef.com, for more info. Keep those questions coming in. Until next time, this has been Chef Ken. Cheers.
So I haven't raised tilapia for quite a while because I don't care what anybody says, the grow period that I have for them here requires an overwintering. They have to come out of my outdoor tanks and come into some sort of indoor heated situation for them to get big enough to be it worth my time. But I did do it for a couple seasons with White Niles. And I did find that the numbers given for how cold they can tolerate are bull, and they can definitely, if they get there over time, get down into like high 30 degree temperatures of what, like 38, 40 degrees and make it. But right around 36 degrees, they all floated to the bottom of the tank. We netted them out, put them in an indoor tank, and they made it through, and then we harvested them that next fall. And they were pretty damn big. They were a couple pounds a piece on average by that period. And here's the method that I came up with that ended up being kind of the best tasting one, but I'm going to also tell you what to do to prevent it from like being ruined like it was the first time I did it. So gochujang is a Korean fermented chili paste, and what I ended up doing with that is heating up some beer and adding, you know, to about maybe 6 ounces of beer, a little bit of soy sauce, about a tablespoon of gochujang to, that make it, to thin it out as a base for the outside. I then rubbed the gochujang on the inside. So I did the fish whole, head on, not skinned, but scaled, and cut like 3 slices in both sides and rubbed the inside good with the gochujang and then basted the outside near the end with the gochujang. And that was freaking phenomenal. There's just a couple more things about this. One, the reason you thin it out and baste with it, if you just rub it on the outside, it's so thick, sticky, and sweet that it burns. It ruins everything. You never get the skin to even crisp a little bit, let alone a decent way. But that was really good. The other thing, though, is salt. I find it interesting that almost everybody that makes steak or pork or anything like that tends to be aware of the fact that salt enhances flavor. You move into the world of fish, and all of a sudden the salt tends to take a back seat. I'm not saying turn this thing into a salt brick, but I'm telling you, salt before you cook, and then salt with finishing salt, and even a little bit of salt out and inside of the fish, and give it some time before other flavorings. Another way to go is very Asian with this, like a lemongrass, ginger chili inside the fish. Make some sort of a base like that for outside. Same technique, scaled, skin on, hash marks, grilled, whole. And there's nothing you can't do with tilapia. There's nothing wrong with tilapia. It had, like Ken said, it has a bad rap because there's so much cheap-ass, pollution-laden tilapia coming in from South America and China both. And I wouldn't even say China, the whole Far East, Malaysia, Singapore, etc. The way that some of these fish are raised is just absolutely awful. But if you're doing it yourself, or if you live somewhere where they're actually available in the wild, and they're even here where I said they won't make it over winter, we have several lakes that are power generation lakes that have water that's heated because of the power generation on them, and they are full of these things. And the only problem here is you need to get an appointment to go fish those lakes. They also require you, if you catch any tilapia, to kill them, which is dumb because they'll never fish them out anyway. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and we got one more before my segment. This is on homestead project debt, and it probably ain't the way you expect it to be.
Hey, TSB community, this is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com, and I'm on my way to Mississippi for a consultation, and I realize that I haven't gotten a segment out to Jack for a couple of weeks, so I wanted to take a minute and answer one of the most common questions that I get from clients, and that question is, how do I keep from spreading myself too thin? I see so many homesteaders fall into the trap of being, as Bilbo Baggins put it, something to the extent of too little butter spread over too much toast. They're barely keeping sane while losing animals, crops, and just have a general lack of attention and poor infrastructure. And unfortunately, a lot of new and seasoned homesteaders fall into the trap of taking on too many projects at once. You know, gardens, animals, orchards. And they tend to do this before they have a solid foundation. I know it's exciting to get started on something, but if you don't pace yourself and prioritize your goals, you'll end up constantly putting out fires instead of building something sustainable. I tend to encourage people to think of homesteading projects like taking on financial debt. A manageable amount taken on with a plan can be really productive. But if you keep stacking on new responsibilities, more animals, more plants, new projects, without finishing what you've already started, it compounds. The best way that I've found to avoid this is to start by writing down your homesteading goals. Take some time to think through them and then try to put them in order of importance. This can actually be pretty hard. You will likely want to write down your goals first, let them sit for a couple of days, and then come back and try to put them in order after you've let that sit for a few days. Some things need to happen before others. For example, if you're thinking about getting goats or sheep, you need proper fencing first. If you don't, you're really setting yourself up for unnecessary stress and extra work and potential catastrophic loss. So set your goals in order to try to make them stick or try to make them make sense in a way that you can actually complete them. It's easy to get sidetracked by a great opportunity as well. You know, if your neighbor has pigs that they're offering for free, or you can get a bulk deal on seeds. But before you say yes to that, you should probably ask a couple of questions. One of them would be, does this item, does this thing fit my long-term goals? And the other that I tend to encourage people to ask is, do I have the time and resources to manage it properly right now? If the answer to either of those is no, I'd say hold off. Another opportunity will come your way when you're more prepared for it. because taking on too much too quickly leads to a homestead that's chaotic instead of productive. There's also a point at which taking on too many things stops being progress and starts creating constant emergencies. One problem ends up leading to another, and suddenly you don't have time to focus on the long-term improvements because you're just trying to keep your head above water. So just like credit card debt, there's a point at which the interest on your homestead projects that you're taking on tips the scales from manageable to destructive, and potentially even catastrophic. So here's a couple of items that I've kind of come to as keys for success in this area. They're really about finishing what you've started before moving on to the next thing, and using the debt snowball method of eliminating projects that are hanging over your head. So most of you are probably familiar with the concept of the debt snowball that that Dave Ramsey promotes. You can do the same thing with essentially the debt, as I'm calling it, that you take on the homestead. So I've got kind of a three-step solution for that. Basically, tackle the important projects first and then build on the momentum. So it always feels really good to actually truly complete a project. So if you've got one started that needs to be finished, finish it. Even if it's not a fun one, when you get to the end of it, you'll feel a lot better about it. And then you can build on that momentum to get the next project and the next project done. You want to make sure to keep your system simple. So when you're building out your systems on your homestead, try to keep them as simple as possible, as few steps to complete them, as easy for, say, a farm sitter or a spouse to come in and take care of if you can't. And then set up the systems so that they tie together. Ideally, all these systems will be working in unison rather than being disparate systems on far-flung parts of your property. Generally, you want to start as close to your home as possible and work out from there slowly from your zone one out to your zone two and so on, rather than trying to use up all the property and space you have. So set those systems up to tie together and be close to each other. I hope that gives everybody at least some encouragement to button up their projects on their homestead, get things done, and reduce stress. If you need help planning your homestead, check out thehomesteadconsultant.com. Or if you have homesteading, creative problem solving, or home maintenance questions, send those into Jack. I really need your questions, and I'd love to help get those questions answered. So to conclude this, take one step at a time, stay focused, and as always, go get your hands dirty.
So when I got this segment and just saw the title of it, I thought he was talking about money. And as soon as I started listening to it, I was like, wow, that I love this analogy. Because a debt is something we get it today and we pay for it tomorrow. And what he's really talking about is we start the project today and we're going to complete it tomorrow. And if we do that enough times, it adds up and it compounds, just like having five different credit cards with small balances. They kill you. And how do you get out of that debt? You go to the smallest credit card debt and you attack it with vicious attack until it's dead. And then you do the next one and you do the next one and you do the next one. And what would be the best thing? Don't go into the debt. Complete those projects. This is a fantastic analogy. I'm totally ripping it off. It will totally be in presentations I do in the future. Thank you so much for that one, Ryan. This is a great, great analogy. One of the best things that I've heard come out of the expert council is like a completely original idea. And I've been doing this. It'll be 17 years in June. All right, with that in mind, let's go ahead and talk about the Trump tariffs. This is the left is losing their mind. And they're losing their mind for the same reason they all. It wouldn't matter what Trump was doing. If somebody was saying we needed to do tariffs and Trump said no tariffs, then they would scream that we need, like, it doesn't matter what Trump does. If the man cures cancer, the left is going to say he's putting doctors out of work, and I'm not exaggerating. There is nothing the man can say or do that anybody on the left is okay with, except appointing, you know, rhinos like Marco Rubio to cabinet positions. Then they're all in. Other than that, it doesn't matter. But I will tell you that there's some specific BS. It's the largest tax increase in history. Only if you buy the stuff. It's everything you buy. No, it's not. Okay? So that in of itself is bullshit. Two, they're making like any price increase, any loss in sales, anything you've seen, any economic indicator up to this point that's negative is because of tariffs. The tariffs didn't start till fucking yesterday, okay? So that's all bullshit. Then the other thing is the consumer will pay 100% of the tariffs. Now, I'm going to get to the rights bullshit in a minute and Trump's bullshit in a minute. But that's also not true. Now, the consumer pays the tariff to a degree, okay? To a degree. Any tax is going to be passed down as much as is feasible to the customer by the supply chain. It's not really any one part of the supply chain, but in the end, the terminal cost, like a tariff is an added cost on the production and delivery of a product. Let's just be honest, that's what it is. So if the price of steel goes up, the price of cars goes up. But it's never 100% pass-through. In the end, any product, any widget, any gadget, from a little bitty stupid thing like an earbud that you listen to the show on, to a car, the consumer market will only bear so much cost. Some of the tariff will be passed through and raise the final cost of the good. Some of the tariff will be absorbed somewhere along in the supply chain, because in the end, the product you're making has got to be priced in such a way that it will sell. Okay? You understand that? Next, the car shit? The car shit's nonsense. Go look at the inventory of F-150s right now. The most popular vehicle in America, they're damn near parking them on the roof of dealerships. Tariffs haven't started yet. Cars are going to go up $26,000. Shut up. For the next 6 months, cars are largely going to be completely unaffected. Completely unaffected. Completely unaffected because there's fucking inventory out the ass of vehicles sitting on the lots. And the only thing you might see is the dealerships, oh wait, they're already doing it, trying to use the tariffs to incentivize selling off their excess inventory they're already sitting on. It's all bullshit. The car manufacturers have already priced themselves in a way that makes car sales suck compared to just 10 years ago. Nothing to do with tariffs because they haven't happened yet. Dodge gets rid of the Challenger, consolidates their sports offering to the Charger, which is basically a two-door Charger, which is kind of what a Challenger was. And I drive a Challenger, I would know. Makes it an electric vehicle, and a base model $60,000. The base model, $60,000 for a Challenger that I bought one in 2020, a gas model, for $24,000 cash off the lot. Pick out my color. Now I got a hell of a deal. Let's be honest. That car was worth $34,000 when I paid $24,000 for it because Dodge freaked out over COVID, and I took advantage of the opportunity to buy. But you get what I'm saying. Like, the cost of that car doubled, had nothing to do with tariffs. So the automakers already have their own problems. In a lot of ways, they've created it for themselves. And the other problem is regulation. So this is what I'm looking for out of Trump if this has a shot of making it. The next thing that has to happen is massive deregulation. There's already been some, but not enough to really make the calculus square out. So now, I've beat up the left here already. I'm going to do it just a little bit more before I move on. And here's my take on this. I would prefer there's no taxes on anything at all. Okay? But I also live in the, like, that's my ideal world. And then I have the pragmatist world, but that's not the world we live in. And this is true. What Trump has said is true. The other countries in the world have taken advantage of us. We have had our turn in the barrel for about, in earnest, 75 freaking years. 75 years, these other countries have tariffed every single thing we send them at exorbitant rates, unless it's something they absolutely have to get from us. And then they still tariff it at modest tariff rates that are in like the 10 to 15% rate. But some of these countries are tariffing a lot of our shit at 60, 70, 80%. Okay? And they've been doing it. And everybody's okay with it. Everybody's allowed to just screw the U.S. in the ass. But we're supposed to just sit here and take it. Well, what are you going to do about it? How do you get a country like Vietnam, who's taxing us at an average aggregate of all the products we ship to Vietnam at over 60%, to stop doing it? You don't do it by bringing all their shit in on a 2% tariff. You don't do it. That's not how that works. If you want free trade, then the other side has to participate in it. And don't give me this. Then why don't we? I've heard this one. In the UK they have a 60% income tax. Why don't we have that here? It's not the same. It's not the same. The purpose of the income tax is to punish production. The purpose of a tariff is, yes, to raise government revenue, but it's also a protectionist strategy. It doesn't mean it's good, but it's what it is, that is designed to incentivize industry within the country imposing the tariff. In other words, we should produce for ourselves first. Now, I have traveled this country. I've talked about this before a lot. And I have traveled this country in a way that most people don't, in a vehicle. And even I, like you truck drivers and all, you spend most of your time on the highway. And you go L.A. to, Dallas and back or something like that. Or L.A. to Dallas, Dallas to, Salina, Kansas, and then back to L.A. Something like that. I've traveled this country a lot, and I've purposefully traveled state highways, county roads, back roads, all over the place I have gone. And what I have seen, especially in the last 20 years, is town after town after town after town that has been literally gutted. And I'm not talking about the opiate problem in Appalachia. I'm talking about towns straight up economic gutted. You can look at this town and you can say, there used to be something here. This was a town people were very happy to live in. This is a place where people, I'm going to raise my kids in this subdivision. This is a beautiful place. And I'm going to get a blue-collar job. I'm going to work at the factory, the plant, whatever it is. And I'm going to earn a good income. I'm never going to be rich, but I'm going to be okay. My family's going to be okay. And my wife can get a job, teaching or being a nurse or a similar job to what I have or what have you. And this is a good place to raise a family. And you can see, like a toilet bowl being flushed, that town's soul was ripped out and exported to India and China and who the fuck knows where, Mexico and Canada, which is more expensive to operate in, yet somehow U.S. companies are operating in Canada, which has higher taxes and is more expensive to operate in, and they're still out, they're able to produce that product in Canada for less than they can in the United States. It's ridiculous. And there does need to be something done about it. And if not this, then what? And this is something that there's a very disingenuous thing going on the left. But when we did it before, it always resulted in a depression. Well, one year they bring up is 1930. I don't know about you, but I was taught the Great Depression started in 1929. So that's bullshit. 1828. Okay, I'll give you that one. But in the 1870s, we did this, and we had so much money, we didn't know what to do with it. That's something Trump told you the truth about. They leave that one out for some reason. They leave it. But here's something that's not been true of 1930, 1870s, 1828. In all those scenarios, the United States was far from the largest market in the world. See, the bigger the market you are, the more power you have when it comes to using this tactic. The truth is, after World War II, the United States spread its butt cheeks and let the entire world lined up to hump it in the ass. We did it under the idea of the Marshall Plan and rebuilding, and it was our responsibility to step as the world leader, and it sounded so great, but we never stopped. Say we had done that for 10 years and said, all right, Tokyo, you guys look good. You're not firebombed anymore. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, they're good. Europe, you got your trains running again and shit. All right, we're the fuck out of here. That might have been okay. That might have been a humanitarian thing, but no. Once you put people on the tit bottle, they stay on the tit bottle. And the United States has been the world's credit card for at least 75 years, at least since the end of World War II, and really before that. But, after World War II, you just ramped it up, and the belief now is that it should just stay the way that it is forever, especially from the left, which is funny because I thought it was the conservatives that wanted things to stay the same way, not the left. Now, the truth is, the right doesn't want this either, when I'm talking about the political class. Now, here's Trump's bullshit. It'll all happen very fast. It won't. You talk about rebuilding the industrial backbone of America and bringing plants in, it will not be fast. It will take at least 2 years, and it will probably cause the Republicans to take it up the ass in the midterms, which is bad for Trump because congressional hearing after congressional hearing after impeachment hearing, blah, 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 blah. The only hope they have with that is that the Senate is able to just say, look, don't fucking waste your time, but they'll do it anyway. And then you'll have 2 years of absolute bullshit and nothing getting done unless he moves much quicker with some other things. Trump's also telling you it won't cost you anything. Just like the Democrats telling you you're going to pay 100% of the tariffs, your president telling you that China's going to pay the tariff and Japan's going to pay the tariff and Vietnam's going to, is bullshit. You're going to pay the majority of the tariff on anything you buy that the tariff is applied on. You are. The suppliers will absorb some. The resellers will absorb some because they're going to have to. They're going to have to cut their margins is what they're going to have to do to keep the product at a sellable price. We're going to go into the worst recession ever, maybe worse than two. That's bullshit, too. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. That's not what this is. So what do you do about it? This is what you do about it. Don't do fucking nothing about it. Don't do fucking nothing about it. Just go on with your life. It is going to affect you a hell of a lot less than you believe that it is for the positive or the negative. If you have Trump derangement syndrome, you're fucked in this. You can't think. And if you have Trump savior syndrome, TSS, you're equally fucked. This is a long-term play to rebuild the industrial backbone of America. And here's the problem. America has turned into a bunch of soft-ass pushies that do not want industrial jobs. So it's going to take, one, massive deregulation, which I think Trump will do as much as he can. But that will be fought and shut down by district judges that are overstepping their authority, and they'll fucking get away with it because your Congress doesn't give a fuck about you, and they want it all to stay the way that it is. And they want to continue to siphon your wealth out of your country because they get a piece of every dollar that leaves. So that's one problem is regulation. Two, again, how many 22-year-old guys want a job working in a factory making $25 an hour right now? Almost none. When you talk about the scale that we need. So now, a lot of that production is going to move into the world of automation and AI. And it's going to take a sea change in the way people even think to make this all work, which may not happen. But in the end, you know what's going to happen? Whatever's going to happen. And it's not going to cause the end of civilization as we know it. You are not going to go out and you're not going to have to start paying $8,000 for one avocado. Like your friends on the Democrat side would want you to believe. It is not the end of all. And most of these countries, I'll tell you right now, it's going to happen. They're going to cave. They're going to cave because in any negotiation, there is one side that has an advantage. And when it comes to economics, as a consumer, that's who has the advantage in a trade war. The consumer will always have a greater advantage than the producer in a trade war. Nobody wins a trade war. Shut the fuck up. That's also a lie. We've been losing a trade war for 70 years. China has been winning the trade war since Nixon gave the most favored nation status in the 1970s. So while the rest of the world's been giving it up to us up the butts for 75 years, China's only been doing it since for 50 years. But that's what's been... They've all won the trade war. And now the same people like Starmer and all out of the UK and Eurocaren out of the EU, what's her name, Legrand, the head of the EU bank, and other Eurocaren, the head of the EU itself, right? All these, you ever notice the two of them look almost the same? Super Eurocaren look there. Nobody wins a trade war. That's because you've been sucking everything out of our country. And we've been paying all your freaking defense bills for 75 years. You've already won it. And you don't want that to change. So I don't give a shit what the tariffs are. I really don't care. Because I know my pay grade, and my opinion will not affect them. Know your pay grade. What you think about this issue doesn't matter as to what will happen. So what you have to do is what you've always done. You make good, smart, consumer-based decisions. Buy things that are designed to last. Then this will mean a lot less. Most of what will be impacted by this are short-term purchases. Short-term purchases. And what shouldn't be a short-term purchase is a car, but it is. We spend more money on cars than we ever have in history based on income relative to cost of car. Right? The last time people had to spend this much of their income to get a car is when cars were brand fucking new and the Model T hadn't been invented yet, when they were only for rich people. When you have cars, basic cars, selling for $60,000, $70,000, and that is more income than the median income of the average worker. So you have to work more than a year to pay for a car before taxes. We're already fucked. We're already fucked. It won't get worse because of this. It may not get better. It won't be fast, and it won't be easy. But if we are ever going to return to the America that we dream of returning to, we have to build things here, we have to make things here, we have to produce things here, we have to mine things here, we have to refine things here. We have to rebuild all of that. This may not work, but there isn't another way for it to happen. You have got to stop having a massive trade imbalance. As the largest consumer, you should be able to have some net control over the in and out so that you balance with your trading partners because you have the leverage. We've basically been the biggest fish in the pond, and we've been letting the minnows nibble our ass. Now, that's not Trump's a genius. That's not Trump's savior syndrome. That's not this is perfect. It's a long shot for it to work. But it's also the only shot. Without this, the other option is you allow this to continue to erode. The middle class gets completely gutted in this country. We become a third world shithole with a group of oligarchs and a group of poor people with almost no middle class. And what they'll call the middle class will be poor. The poor is the new middle class. Gee, didn't Jack Spirico say something about downward class migration over a decade ago? Here it is. And once somebody tries to stop it, they try to shoot him in the head, they try to put him in prison, and they will continually shriek like lunatics no matter what the man does. If I'm telling you right now, if Trump, he ain't going to do it, but if he personally cured cancer, they'd say he's putting doctors out of work. If he personally cured the flu, he'd say he's putting manufacturers of vaccines out of work. There is nothing the man can do that will make those people happy. And we should stop even caring about what they say. Those are my thoughts. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up. I appreciate you guys tuning in today. Again, let me remind you, you do have the LFTN tickets. There's four of those left if you want to come see me up in Tennessee at the end of the month. Permaculture Pond Masterclass from Ben Falk. Check that out. Tomorrow we'll have a Friday flashback. And then Monday we'll start and do it all over again.
You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.